Welcome to the Antisocial Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. This episode is a bit different to the ones that I've done in the past. This one features a gentleman by the name of Kai Lofgren, and I probably mispronounced his surname, but Kai is the director of an establishment called School of Life Australia, which is primarily based in Melbourne, but is starting to sprout in other parts of the country, soon to be Sydney. It's a very exciting business and platform and resource for people, and is functioning in a number of different facets that evoke new ways of thinking, embracing the arts and philosophy and whatnot, and doing its best to change, I guess, the social pressures that we put on ourselves and the outlooks that we have on life. It's a bit of a hard thing to explain, and I do put Kai on the spot to ask what School of Life is about. And as you can see, it's not a very simple thing. It's quite complex and it's quite involved. And because of that, it's quite exciting because there's so many opportunities and avenues and that could open up and will open up in future with School of Life. Now, if you want to listen to an episode where I stumble and stutter all the way through it, this is the episode for you. I found myself lost for words and losing my train of thought all the way through it. I have no idea why, but I was incredibly nervous doing this one with Kai. I don't know why. I think because part of the reason is we were trying a number of times to align our schedules to chat, and there was a couple of times where we had to postpone. And I think just it all built up to a point where I was just stressing the hell out just to try and get this over the line and get it recorded. So it got to a point where I was just running around in circles with some of my questions or statements and whatnot. But I think regardless of that, while you can have a laugh at me making a fool of myself, it's a really cool episode, and there's a lot of really interesting things and topics that will evoke a lot of thought and conversation. And I'm going to put a lot of resources on the website on andysocial.net, and I'll put them on Facebook as well that you guys can check out. I think the YouTube channel for School of Life is absolutely incredible, and I really encourage you guys to go there first as a way to dip the toe in the water, so to speak, and get an understanding of what it's all about. And it's a great way to share different ideas and opinions and perspectives and whatnot by using these YouTube videos. And of course, there's the website, and for people that are in Melbourne, you guys have got an incredible resource there with a lot of workshops that are constantly happening every week. And for people in Sydney, that's starting to also be the case as well. For people overseas, there are a number of global offices and resources for you guys. So definitely go and check out the School of Life website, and you'll be able to find where the nearest one is to you. And over time, of course, that's going to become more and more accessible as more and more people become aware of it. So anyway, enough of my rambling. You can listen to my rambling in the episode itself with Kai. I'm going to have all the links on andysocial.net, but enjoy this conversation. I'm just going to jump right into it because I've got a whole bunch of stuff. I've been trying to work out a way of structuring this a little bit, but I'll just see where it goes, and I'll keep an eye on the time as well. So maybe just an introduction for the people listening. Do you want to explain, whether it be the long or the short of it, of what School of Life is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the School of Life was born in the UK around 2007, 2008. Really, it was born out of a small group of people led most famously by Alain de Botton, who's a very popular philosopher I'm sure many of your listeners would be familiar with. Mm-hmm. And Alain came together with a range of other people, including, you know, a guy called Roman Krusnarek, who was the global authority on empathy these days, a really strong philosopher in his own right, and a few others. And basically they came together around this idea that although they were very successful, and Alain in particular, extremely successful writers, they had sort of realized that most of the fundamental human shifts and impacts that they had through their words actually occurred in conversations when people were talking about their work, not necessarily just from reading books. And so I guess they took that little piece of insight that the transformation always happens in interaction with others, or often happens in interaction with others. And they, I guess, were interested in experimenting with that idea and drawing it out a little bit. So they put on about five or six different experiences in a small shopfront in London, in Bloomsbury. And they were things around how to find a job you love, how to be creative, how to be confident, a few kind of core ideas. And they were just ragingly successful. They were sold out for, you know, for years, these core experiences. And that was kind of the birth of the School of Life. It was taking these works of philosophy, these ideas of, you know, the power of art and culture, and making them into a physical experience. And then I guess as the popularity of that grew, we started to work a little bit in the kind of retail and stationery space, so creating products that people could, you know, have as almost mementos of their learning experience and having as learning tools. And then they expanded the range of content quite heavily. So instead of just focusing on a few core areas, we grew that to many of the kind of broad arc of human concerns that we all experience from birth to death. Everything from love and work and friendship and relationships, major human concerns, and created content around those. And then in more recent times, as the school has gone global, which we can chat about a little bit, we've also started doing quite a lot of work with business and with private organizations. So people would come to our experiences and then they would think that, you know, this class on creativity would work really well in my office, or this class on vulnerability and empathy would work really well for my executive team. And so we started doing a little bit more curated programming for private organizations as well. So these days, the school has physical branches in about 10 locations around the world. Australia is about to become the first place in the world that has two branches, so one in Melbourne and one in Sydney. We also have a sort of, within those branches, we have a cafe and a bookshop, which operates as a really nice community hub space. And then we also have this public program. And then, as I mentioned, we've got this business school, which is along the side of what we do. So I guess wrapping all of that up, effectively the school is committed to connecting people back to the humanities, back to art, back to culture, back to philosophy, in a really practical and meaningful way in their lives. And we are proudly and vehemently secular as an organization, and we believe that there's a huge role to play for the arts and the humanities in supporting all of us through, you know, the major life challenges and questions that we all face.
It's very multifaceted. I mean, just going through what you've just gone through and mentioned all the different aspects of what School of Life's about and the different services that it can provide. It's just, there's quite a bit to it, and I guess it's exciting and probably leaves a lot of doors open for further things down the track, and the whole philosophy, I guess School of Life itself, it's a philosophy that would be an environment and a culture that would continue to expand and get bigger and bigger as more opportunities and more of the populace gets behind it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, I mean, that's the challenge, right? When you ask me the question of how do you describe the school, I mean, the five-word description is we are committed to developing emotional intelligence through culture. That's the sentence, right?
Yeah.
But within that, you know, you can do that in your personal life, in your work life, in your love life. You can do that through books, through products, through digital videos and text. You can do it through physical experiences. You can do it through one-on-one therapies. There's a whole range of mechanisms. And then when you're talking about, you know, what is culture, well, then you're talking about everything from, you know, music and poetry to theatre and political science and economics and philosophy and the arts and the fine arts and dance. And like, there's so many things that make up what it is that we call culture. So, yeah, it's a tremendously exciting space to be in because, it, as you mentioned, it can go in so many directions and there is so much appetite for us to get in touch with, I guess, the greater questions of what it is to be human. And we feel like there's a really big opportunity to do that in a very secular and very playful way.
And I guess the thing that really excites me about the idea behind it all is that it's something that I think where we are in, I guess, I'm just going to compare with Australian culture and where we've been over the past several decades. This is all very new, and it's really going to challenge the way that people live and the way that people look at life, and right down to things like work-life balance. You know, how we interact with each other, especially with the, you know, this dominating digital age that's coming in and taking over a lot of things as well. But a lot of the teachings and the philosophies and everything behind it are, in some cases, you know, hundreds of years old or decades, and it's old teachings, but they translate and they're still relevant now. So it's amazing that I guess in a culture now where, especially in the digital age, where if it's not fresh, I'm comparing this to more the younger generation than anything else, but if it's not fresh and new, it's not worth paying attention to. But I'm assuming that with a lot of the teachings and what I've seen from School of Life that's been put online, a lot of it's ancient, a lot of it's hundreds of years old, and it's stuff that's relevant now and it still works. It's still the basic qualities and the basic core behind it still applies now, and it's probably more important than it ever has been before.
Yeah, and I wouldn't argue with any of that. I think that there is to some extent, a counter movement now that is very strongly searching for effectively what is the kind of unchanging nature of being human. Which, although we'd like to think we live in the most rapidly changing times, in human history, and sure, I'm sure there are metrics that show that to be true, but at the same time, there's anxiety and huge anxiety and psychological concerns that go alongside living in that type of era. And I think that it is a false assumption that people can just adapt in those environments without support. And the great classic works of philosophy and literature and art and even music are fundamental in terms of reminding people what are the fundamentals of their human nature. And until you have a really good understanding of self and who you are and what you want to do in the world, then it's really difficult to even start having conversations about what job do I want in this ever-changing economy, or what do I look for in a partner to be with in my life, or not at all? What is the difference between loneliness and solitude in the digital age? These questions are profound and not easy to navigate on your own. And I think what we find with the school is many, many people who come to visit our experiences or go online to our YouTube channel or engage with us in some way, they're highly educated people. They're doing reasonably well in the kind of superficial socioeconomic state. They're reasonably happy, I guess you could say, in the most superficial definition. And they're reasonably well, their well-being is okay. But what they've hit up against, a transition point in their life that they weren't expecting, or if they were expecting, they weren't prepared for. So what I'm talking about is, for example, you might go and study a vocational discipline like engineering or accounting or law, or be a highly educated postgraduate person. You might work then for 5 or 10 years, and then you might be fired from your job, or you might have a relationship breakdown, or you might lose a parent, or you might have some sort of a psychological trauma, and find that you are actually horribly unprepared for what it means to live. And for those people who have for a long time felt quite successful, that's a rude shock. And some people at those moments, they turn to the church if they grew up in the church, or maybe they find God in some other way, or they turn to their close family and friends and find support there. But there aren't that many forums around us where you can go and have non-judgmental conversations in a secular space which invites the serious questioning without trying to provide big answers. There really isn't anywhere or wasn't anywhere before the School of Life came along. And so I guess we pride ourselves on being that space, on being that community where you can ask questions that in other forums might seem a bit naive or a bit, a bit insecure. So that's kind of our service. And I guess I also want to say that there is a huge group of people who come to the school very much for cultural entertainment. So some people come here because they have a big concern that they're trying to work through, like the death of a partner or finding a new job. And other people just come here because they want to explore culture again in a new way. They come here because they want to, they were vaguely interested in philosophy, but they never studied it. So they come to one of our philosophy salons where they get to meet, a classic philosopher from through the ages being presented by a modern philosopher. Or they come to a philosophy breakfast where they, get to chat with 12 strangers about some core philosophical concepts. So we also have that kind of angle, which is very much that people are looking for cultural experiences that aren't your traditional going to a gallery or going to a film or whatever it might be. So I think we serve both functions. We serve a function for those who are in a moment of crisis in their lives, and also a function for those who are really just culturally curious.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to what you said about where somebody might be traveling on along a fairly comfortable and successful path, and then a life event of some sort occurs and throws them off balance. One thing that I've noticed a lot with School of Life and a lot through the videos and whatnot is really sort of promoting that balance between optimism and pessimism. And in the world of self-help and that's a massive industry in itself, which can, and I shouldn't, for a lack of a better word, can suck a lot of people in, but there are a lot of benefits in that industry depending on who you gravitate towards. But a lot of it's based on just primarily positive thinking. And I feel, just from my own personal experiences, that if I weigh too heavily on positive thinking, if something does go wrong, then I'm not equipped to be able to handle the negativity or a negative situation that pops up in life, as it happens to all of us. So the from what I've seen, just from some of the videos online and written articles and whatnot, is to really highlight that, you know, the realities of life. I guess that's a big thing. It's to say that, you know, we're not gonna put the rose petals around and say that everything's going to be fine. And if you're thinking positively all the time, that you'll get through all of life's hurdles. It's fine to feel, and I guess that's on the topic of mindfulness as well, is just understanding and accepting when things go wrong or when you're not feeling well, and that it's normal to feel those ways.
Yeah, again, I mean, I think you and I could probably dedicate an entire podcast series to the happiness industry.
Yeah.
And I'd love to do that if I had another life. I mean, I think I couldn't agree more, in the sense that I think what we've just been through in kind of Western thought is an era of relatively slimy self-help, of at the worst kind of a sense of exploitation of the human condition to sell products and books and whatever. And I think that there's a huge spectrum of work there. So there's elements of the more traditional self-help industry which serves a vital purpose, and there's elements of it which are really quite horrible. I guess the School of Life's position is one where, in a philosophical sense, we are very non-dogmatic. We don't profess to have answers in any significant way. What we profess to do is use the humanities and culture to reframe people's questions and to provide a space where, in a non-judgmental way, people can explore what I said before could be described as naive questions, like what does it mean to live a good life, and how do I work out exactly what it is I want to do with my job and what I look for in a partner, questions that generally speaking we ponder on our own. And so having a forum and tools from some of the great thinkers to explore those questions is a profound thing, and that's kind of our service to the world. And I guess within that, what we often talk about is that the idea that we should be pursuing a superficial notion of happiness as a goal is not only fundamentally misguided, in the sense that one cannot know even superficial happiness, even, you know, if we don't want to start talking about genuine flourishing and happiness. But one can't enjoy that human condition without having an understanding of what the other side looks like in its full spectrum.
Absolutely.
And so the idea that you should be pursuing one thing over and above the full spectrum of the human condition is deeply flawed, and probably has something to do with the fact that we have ever increasing rates of mental illness in our community, and I think we're heading towards something quite profound realization that endless pursuit is not what we should be doing.
Mm.
And I actually think that the arts is brilliant at engaging in this question in a really nuanced way, because you don't turn to a writer like Virginia Woolf or the music of Bach just to become happy. You turn to these materials to engage in a much deeper and more nuanced set of human emotions.
Mm.
And that's an incredible consolation in times of pain or in times of feeling unhappy. And it can be an incredible source of consolation. It doesn't necessarily make you happy or do away with that emotion, but it can make you feel less alone and less isolated. And they are incredibly important services that the greats of human culture can offer us.
Absolutely. And I think that's a big thing that I've noticed, is that I think a lot of this is about reassurance and understanding that, you know, for all the differences that we all have, and we are unique individually, at the same time, we do have core experiences that we all go through at various times in our lives. And I think when you, and yes, I won't touch too much on the self-help stuff, but in a comparison to a lot of the self-help world, you're very much isolated, and the pressure's put on you to achieve through a number of instructions that are quite misguided and put a lot of additional stress and pressure on a situation to achieve. And if you don't, then, you know, your whole world falls apart. So it's not, there's no reassurance or collaboration between other people with you that are like-minded in the right way. So that's a big positive that I've experienced from, you know, the little bits and pieces that I've seen from School of Life.
And I think that's, I mean, a good articulation of that, I think, is that a lot of our core content, our core kind of experiences and workshops, the narrative arc of them is quite similar. So if you think about, you know, we've got experiences, one's called how to be confident, how to be creative, how to have better conversations. A lot of these experiences are firstly quite playfully titled and are rather ironic because we don't provide a five-step guide to confidence. It's much less prescriptive than that, but we call it how to because we think it's a playful entry point.
Yeah.
But I guess that the narrative arc that is similar is that the first portion of these experiences is almost always dedicated to placing the human concern, so confidence, creativity, finding work, in a quite deep cultural history.
Mm.
So we might talk about what did confidence and the idea of confidence, how did that get spoken about in the Romantic period or in Plato's period or in the Industrial Revolution, or how has the human expression of that changed in time, and therefore what is how we feel today about confidence and how we reward confidence today, how does that compare to, you know, human history, and what that placement, that kind of relative placement of the human concern, what that does for people is realize that, you know, what we feel today is we're not alone in human history, and let alone that, we're also not alone in the room with the 25 people who have chosen to be in the experience with you. So there's kind of a lifting of pressure immediately after that kind of content has been delivered and there's been conversations around it. So before we even talk about how you might start addressing the human concern and ideas and tools and playful things that one can test in your own life, we've already released some of that pressure valve that people feel when they enter experience like that. And so, yeah, culture and the humanities provide an incredible tool just to realize that we're much less alone than we perhaps thought we were.
Absolutely. And you mentioned before about, I guess, that at this point in time, the demographic of the type of people that are coming to the school life at present, more affluent people that have already found a bit of success so far and are doing reasonably well, but are looking for additional tools or they've hit a kink in the road and they need to look for a bit more, I guess, of the bigger purpose in life and whatnot. I guess looking down the track to see where School of Life goes, is there things in mind or plans to put in place as to how to reach out to a larger demographic of people? Because a lot of people that I know or have grown up with would, and I guess this is probably things that from the self-help world has probably caused a lot of problems and probably a lot of challenges for you guys now, is to try and get people to even be aware or to show some interest in what School of Life is about and the teachings, because a lot of people are so sucked up in their everyday life and in that automatic pilot that they won't go outside the box to try and seek, you know, a different perspective or new teachings.
Yeah, it is a strategic challenge and it's almost an existential challenge for us around who it is that we're trying to reach and how do we do that in a way that's responsible, that sits kind of within our mandate to some extent and serve those who really need us. I think there's a couple of points to it. One is that we have, when I described the kind of core demographic before, it's really highly related to the physical experience of coming to the school for a 3-4 hour experience all the way up to kind of a 5-day intensive. It's the kind of the high touch end of the school. But we were very conscious when we set the school up in Australia, and we set it up quite differently to the way they did it originally in the UK, where we set up a cafe and bookshop in Melbourne. Where the only barrier to entry was buying a coffee, to be able to come and sit in a space that was looked and felt quite different to other cafes, but also was inviting you to have, you know, slightly more interesting conversations with the people that you were meeting with or in fact strangers in the cafe. So one of the things that we do in the cafe is we hand out little conversation cards with every single coffee we give out, and they have just a random and rather profound question on them. So I was having a meeting this morning in the cafe, and the one that I got from the barista was, what close member of your family do you like the least? which is a rather brilliant question because it says as much about you as it does about that person.
Absolutely.
and you know, we have questions about, you know, what for you would be a good death, and when was the last time you didn't throw your head back in laughter, and just random provocations.
Mm.
And I guess those provocations aren't designed so that we can collect data or do anything in a practical sense. It's just to encourage a slightly different type of conversation. So I guess our conversation cafe it has its own theory of change behind it. And that is that we think we can get people to ask slightly different questions and therefore perhaps spark a different thought than they might have had if they'd gone to the cafe next door or down the road. Mm. And that's I think that's a theory of change in and of itself, with no barrier to entry, really. And then I guess we also have a very significant presence online. We've invested very, very heavily in our YouTube channel, where we have more than 300 videos already, and they get produced at a rate of knots. And we have more than 1 million subscribers globally. And that's growing, again, in the rates of the very many thousands every day. And I guess that is, again, an opportunity for people to engage in our content, in our tone, and in our way of thinking about, common human challenges without leaving their bedroom, let alone coming and spending $80 on a practical experience. Mm. And what we do find is that the demographic online is, of course, very different to the demographic that comes to our experiences. That our online content skews quite male, quite strongly. So, 70-80% of the viewers on YouTube are male, and the inverse applies for our physical experiences. So we have 70 to 75% of our audience for our public program in Melbourne, for example, is female. And so, you could psychoanalyze those figures, or you could just say that, people prefer receiving information and content like this in different ways. And we try and cater as much as we can for the breadth of it. It's also worth saying that I think our public program itself has lots of different offerings. We have what we call a Sunday morning series, where we have great cultural thinkers presenting a 45-minute secular sermon coupled with a popular musician who plays songs to a particular theme on a Sunday morning, in Federation Square in Melbourne for 400 people once every 6 weeks or so. And that's a very passive experience. You come at 11 o'clock, you sit back, you get a bit of cultural entertainment and a few big ideas, and then you're on your way. And then we have a philosophy breakfast, which is, again, 12 people and very informal, very casual. And then we do have a five-day intensive, where you come together with the same 25 people for 5 days, and you basically do a significant life audit, so to speak, and rethink many elements of your life. And so that's clearly a more intensive experience that requires you to be in a particular place psychologically and indeed financially. But we do try and provide, a variety of access points, because we absolutely see the importance of our content for everybody.
And I guess that, well, that definitely covers it in the sense that you guys have already got, you're already touching a lot of a wider range of people through all those different facets. And especially, I've spent several hours on the YouTube channel just going through video after video, and it's incredible the stuff on there. And when I talk to somebody about School of Life and somebody who's might be a little bit critical in general in life, and I'll usually send a video like that, and it's a great entry point for somebody to even start thinking a different way, or to get them into the right headspace. So that in itself is such an important tool that that will bring a lot of those people that are probably a little bit skeptical of that type of way of thinking and whatnot, where I think, especially when you're looking at probably the blue collar demographic, where they're not really thinking much outside of work and then couch and bed, and that's about it. And for a lot of those people, that's just how life has been, and that's their that's generation after generation, and they won't really think outside or go outside those routines that they've got in place. And the YouTube videos themselves have I think, and I'm sure that you've seen it as well, as a great tool to at least just get people to dip their toe in the water, so to speak. And then obviously, as you said, the things in Federation Square and whatnot are great for passerbys, and then obviously people that can rock up without any real commitment or anybody actually turning around saying, oh, you're here, and they're meant to participate.
And I think there's a lot in that, and it's absolutely the function that we hope the YouTube channel can play. I would say that I think that the world of culture and philosophy, if I can put it in such broad terms, has failed the mainstream, particularly in the last 50 years. So there was a time when, philosophy and art and culture was so much more closely interlinked with our everyday lives, and yet post war in the West, it's gone more and more into academic institutions, more and more talking to itself. And although I love, for example, Melbourne's cultural scene and Sydney has a similarly thriving scene, it's a relatively insular one. And it's one that doesn't necessarily get outside a core demographic very easily. I know a lot of institutions are trying really hard to break that, but that's been the case for a long time. And so it's quite hard to break down. Mm. And I don't think this is about saying that, people who don't engage with museums or music or philosophy or poetry aren't able to. I actually think it's about saying that the cultural institutions, the people who have been bastions of this information and culture for a long time, they've failed, and they need to step up to the plate in a way that they haven't before. And as I said, a lot of them are trying and are doing wonderful work, but I actually think it's very much on us to say, if we believe in the power of culture to change lives in a positive way, then we need to do better at explaining why that's the case and how that's the case, and getting new ways of communicating that message. And I guess one of the things that I hope the school can do is support that process to say that, you know, that there is no reason why, you know, and I know that there are many tradies who read poetry, and there are many, you know, bank tellers who engage with philosophy, and we need to encourage much more of that rather than saying that they're not capable of doing that or we shouldn't try. I think if we continue only serve existing cultural audiences, then we're not actually changing the world at all. We're not creating any deep impact. And I guess we're big believers at the School of Life that popularizing something doesn't dilute its inherent value. And that's a paradigm that unfortunately many people in art and culture just fundamentally disagree with. They believe that as soon as something becomes popular, it loses some value. And that's something we have to fight against really strongly.
Yeah, absolutely. A big challenge. But I mean, I've seen that in working in music for years and years. You see that on a daily basis, and it's a constant challenge. But I guess even just in philosophy in general, it's something that when you use like the example of a tradie that reads poetry, it's, you know, that person probably feels themselves that they couldn't tell their colleagues that they do that, or they have an interest in that, because there's a social stigma attached to it as well. The popularization of that, maybe for that person, well, they might actually think that they're unique, or that they feel special because they're the only ones that are doing that amongst their tradie friends. But I guess the popularization of it, they might feel that that's no longer special or important to them if it becomes mainstream.
Yeah, that's true. And I think often it's actually that people have never been invited or never been given permission to explore something. And I think we can all reflect on that in our own lives, that even if we feel like we might have, you know, had a quite a cultured upbringing, or have been experiencing, you know, really big life conversations for a long time, and we've been lucky enough to have a circle of friends that engages with that, we've still all got blind spots. You know, we've still got areas that we haven't been able to, or think we've been permissioned to explore, or various elements of culture that we just don't understand. You know, if I go to the opera, I really enjoy it, but I don't understand what I'm really listening to or watching. No one's ever held my hand through that cultural experience to explain its power. And I think that is something that, you know, the world of art has shied away from, particularly in the last, you know, few decades, this idea that one might have to, you know, actually explore with somebody why a particular work of art is powerful and why it would resonate with people. Ask the question of what is art for and what is music for? Not so that you have to have a utilitarian reason for its existence. It's not saying that, you know, art must be therapeutic or useless. That's not the point at all. It's just saying that by asking the question and allowing people to question and explore the answer and to live in that question, as, you know, Rilke would say, allowing people to do that is actually a fundamental reason why art has existed forever, is to provoke questions in people and provoke this bigger conversation. And I think when you walk into some contemporary art galleries or go to some cultural experiences, they're built in such a way as to actually block those conversations, or to make people feel naive and stupid if they were there to ask something. And that needs to be broken down, because that hasn't always been the case with the fine arts, and that's actually a product of our current interpretation, and that can change.
Oh, that's something that I've experienced firsthand. I've walked into a number of art galleries over the years and just went, you know what, I don't think this is my place. I don't think this is where I'm being accepted. And you almost feel like you're being judged.
I don't belong here.
Yeah, as soon as you walk through the doors, you go, well, someone's looking at me going, what's that guy doing in here? And that guy doesn't know what he's actually seeing, what's in front of him. And I guess that comes down to, luckily for me, over time, I've been able to remove a lot of that self-defeating dialogue that I have internally and just go, you know, enjoy it for what it is, even if I don't know sometimes what I'm looking at. But it is something that I think it's just an old stigma that's been there for the last several decades, where there's been a real segregation of different facets of life and when it comes to the arts. And I think because the arts has been neglected in some ways, that the people that are truly passionate about the arts have probably become a little bit snobbish about it as well, because they've been segregated. So it becomes such an important part of them that, they're probably very, in some cases, unwilling to open it up to more people. So there's probably a challenge on both sides in some ways.
You know, there definitely is. And look, you can't separate the political from this conversation either. Mm. And the way that the arts is treated politically is a travesty. And the fact that we cannot see that, you know, that ultimately the humanities and the art and culture form the heart of our entire society, and that we need to treat them with, you know, the utmost respect from a resourcing and cultural perspective. You can't separate that out. And it's not surprising that in a culture of our environment where funding is lost, left, right, and centre. And again, last week we saw, you know, huge number of art and cultural organisations getting defunded. You can't separate the fact that that creates a certain tension in society. And so it's certainly not putting blame in various places, but I think we all have to look at, you know, take a very macro view of this and have conversations about what do we want our society to look like. And again, that's a naive question and one that's not often asked without a little smirk at the end of it. Mm. But what do we want it to look like? And how do we make sure that the institutions we support and the things that we do in our everyday lives is actually working towards that society? And clearly, a society where we don't value the art is one that I don't want to live in.
It just creates that divide more and more, especially when you're trying to bring the worlds together, especially from a group of people or a facet of the community that aren't involved in the arts and don't understand it and as a result don't respect it. And when they see that, you know, from a political point of view, a lot of the arts aren't getting taken seriously anymore, then that message gets sent back to those people and just reaffirms their ignorance of what the arts is and the importance of it. So it definitely has a challenge. But I guess maybe on the back of that, and I guess a lot of the people that are coming to the School of Life, and I guess even probably online for the most part, are people that are already in their adult phase of life. Is there something that, I mean, it might not be right now, but is there something that eventually down the track that you'd like to be able to, and you might already be doing it, I could completely miss it, but where you're really tapping into the younger demographic? And because for me, growing up, none of this is in school, and it hasn't been in school. And I spoke to a professor a while back about mindfulness, and he mentioned that there were high schools, at least in Victoria, that were starting to add classes on mindfulness. It's just one example. And I was quite surprised by that, because we never had anything like that when I was going through the ranks. And a lot of these teachings would be so beneficial for children and teenagers going through, especially, oh geez, being a teenager, you need all the support you can get. So is there anything that School of Life's doing or would like to do down the track that will tap into that age demographic?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And you know, as a starting point, I'd say that if the formal education system did what it should do, then we wouldn't have to exist.
Yeah.
So I think that there is absolutely significant issues with the way our education system is structured in the West and particularly in Australia, I think, because that's all we can really refer to. But the number of people we get through our experiences who make statements like, if I had come to an experience when I was 17, I wouldn't have spent 15 years in the job that I hated. I'd be a rich man if I got a dollar every time someone had said something like that. Mm. Or, for example, you know, if I'd understood what if I'd been able to explore open forum, what I thought love was when I was 18, 19, then I wouldn't have been in a bad relationship for 10 years. So it's not just professional. It's also deeply, deeply personal. And I guess what we've kind of set ourselves up with this with much more of an adult focus, but we're very conscious that our digital content is playing beautifully, particularly for teenagers and older teenagers. Again, because it's asking some of those slightly more naive questions that society doesn't tend to want to ask. And a lot of the videos are framed in a way that can be, I mean, they're very rigorous in their design, but they're very playful as well. And so they're deeply accessible for, I think, all ages, and obviously freely available on the internet. So there's no access issues there. Mm. And in terms of programming, we have done some piloting in Australia. And there's been a small amount of piloting overseas with actually running experiences for teenagers, and for all, particularly 15 to 19-year-olds. We've run a pilot in Perth with the school over there, and we are looking in our kind of mid-term or mid to long-term to be moving a little bit more in that direction.
Mm.
I would say, though, that there's kind of a... to get a bit technical, there's a little bit of a distribution issue, because the best way of doing this would be partnering with schools and school networks, and saying that, you know, either as part of a core curriculum or even as an elective after school, it'd be wonderful, you know, to get that into the system itself. But of course, then you hit up against, well, are we going to service the public school system, in which case there'd be a huge bureaucracy, or are we going to, you know, service the private school industry, in which case you've got an equity issue? So there's lots of questions to explore. And we've tested a couple of other delivery mechanisms through, you know, intermediary organisations, for example, that have a youth focus, and doing it through those guys, or even running it through our public program directly and just advertising that we're this is a class for, say, 15 to 19-year-olds. So there's certainly avenues open to us, and I guess we're always curious about how we might be able to meet kids where they are with our content. I think there's a huge opportunity there.
No, absolutely. And I always look, especially just doing the line of work that I do, and then also just working in music as well, where it's very much... And you try not to pigeonhole people or stereotype too much, but you know, you look at it, sometimes you go back to the old generational thing, and different generations are a lot harder to crack than others. And I always sort of think, well, it gets to a point sometimes where a particular generation, there's not a great deal more that you can do. And that might sound a bit negative, so to speak, but where I'm just trying to think of challenges that we've had within music, and we always think, well, what we should be doing instead of spending the majority of our effort focusing on sort of the older generation, who it's like the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, going and really sort of getting the younger generation while they're still absorbing and learning and whatnot. But I think you need to still have that balance where you're still out there and providing services for people regardless of what age they are. But I assume that, I mean, moving forward for the long term for all of us, the next generation is going to be extremely important as to where we all go.
And there's no way one can argue against that. I think there's a critical need to look at the way we educate from the ground up, from early childhood all the way through to tertiary education. And I think it's happening whether we like it or not, of course, because there is this explosion of alternative education organisations all over the Western world and the world more generally, particularly, of course, and most potently at the tertiary level, where university institutions are getting undermined in a quite ruthless and radical way, and quite a deserved way often. And then there's also a kind of, I think there is more and more conversations around what does alternative education look like at primary school and high school level as well, because, in our school system, we are from a very young age pushed into very vocational pathways, and that just doesn't lead to a flourishing life. It's as simple as that. And there's huge gaps that we see in the human condition as people mature.
I've seen that firsthand myself. Going through, I was one of those kids that was an absolute handful going right through school, right to the end of high school, where I just rebelled. You're forced to, it was interpreted as being forced to go along a particular path. And if you didn't, then it was frowned upon. And I wanted to prove a point that I didn't have to do that. And, I kicked and screamed along the way. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I really sort of found a love for learning and wanting to be open-minded and upskill myself and get a bit more of an understanding of the world around me. Whereas up until that point, I had tunnel vision, and it was more of a rebellious nature that I had. And I think, that's just growing up in general, but I think a lot of that, without throwing excuses to other areas, is that, I wasn't in an area that was supportive, even on an emotional level, or just to really understand the individual rather than just a blanket approach structure that everybody should conform to. So it's a very difficult thing.
And the interesting thing about that, your story is that clearly the education system didn't really work for you in a general sense. But I would also argue that for those who went through very, quote, successfully, unquote, through the education system, it fundamentally didn't work for them either. So, absolutely. I mean, I put myself in a ladder camp in the sense that I was always a pretty good student. I was, you know, at the top end of the class academically. I was told I was very good. I went to a public school in Melbourne, quite a fragmented public school in Melbourne, and I was always kind of one of the top kids because I did quite well academically. And so I was pushed into kind of various very obvious pathways of engineering and law and medicine, because that was what you do when you're like that. And so I went off and did an engineering degree, a civil engineering degree, and some drop of wisdom probably on behalf of my parents, I also did an arts degree. So I did both of these together. And if I hadn't done my arts degree, I think I would have had a very significant quarter life crisis. And that's what a lot of my mates in engineering had. You know, they had been on very similar pathways. They'd been told they were great for a long time. They'd been pushed into a discipline which was, you know, booming in that time in Australia. You know, being an engineer had a lot of prestige and lots of jobs and lots of money. And so there was a natural kind of momentum behind people's education. And then they hit a bump in the road at some point, and that might be a relationship breaking down, or you know, when the boom in engineering ended and everyone got fired. And so you'd have this moment in your life where you go, actually, you know what, all that stuff that I was told that I was great and life was easy and, you know, I was super smart and incredibly intelligent, all that stuff is kind of bullshit. And it doesn't actually play a significant role when it comes to navigating the trauma of being human. And ultimately the art, you know, and the arts aren't taught particularly well either, I would argue, in a lot of cases as well. But the arts at a general level, that's exactly what it can provide. It can provide the envelope and the material and the stories and the examples of how you navigate the, you know, the pleasures and pains of life. And you can never get that from a medical degree or an engineering degree or anything else. It's got to come through A, life experience, and B, leaning on those who have come before us.
Absolutely. And the other thing that I noticed from friends of mine who did quite well in school, getting into that first year of tertiary education, and the dropout rate was just incredible. And a lot of those people were just so burnt out from the process of going straight from high school into tertiary, and just no opportunity to come up for air. And those people just went out of the educational system altogether and went and got a 9-to-5 job and settled down, and they're happy enough, but that whole plan where they've been prepped for so many years just stopped abruptly because it was just too much. They just burnt out because there was just so much pressure put on them for so long. And I think there was probably a little bit when you get to the tertiary platform where when you start to come of age a little bit, and I can only just go from the experiences that I've seen around me, that people then suddenly have an awakening to say that I don't have to be here anymore. Whereas in high school or primary school or whatnot, then there's that expectation that you need to be there. And so then that's another reason why a lot of people are dropping out in the first year or so when they're getting into university. So it's, there's a lot of areas there that really need to be improved over time. But I guess, you know, it's a big challenge, and it's going to be a long process. But having, as you said, a multitude of platforms out there for people to begin to start thinking a particular way now will slowly start to shift things long term. But it's going to be a long process.
Well, it is, and I mean, but I'm not disheartened by that. I think there's a kind of there's a natural momentum with these things, and I think there are a number of trends now that would say that that's not going to be as long and tedious as we would perhaps fear.
Yeah.
You know, obviously technology is being one of those. And also I think the funny thing about technology as a trend is that it's deeply paradoxical. We have obviously the fear and anxiety around technology, around it, you know, creating disconnection in the human experience, and, you know, everyone's on their phone all the time and not talking to each other and not engaging. There's that kind of fear. Then there's the, which I think is, you know, partly very true, and needs to be, you know, one needs to be careful and conscious about it, and perhaps more conscious than we have been around human connection than ever before. But then, of course, technology is also the thing that's enabled us to have much better oversight of the human condition. So what is it we have the potential to do? You know, a teenager today can, in using very significant tools that are freely available, you know, map out potential pathways for themselves in terms of careers, and have much better visibility over what is possible to do as a human being in a way that they couldn't 20 years ago when they went to the career counselor at school and said, what do I want to do? And they said, what are you good at? And you said, math. And I said, okay, engineering. Like that's such a horribly linear way of thinking about a career than compared to what one can do now on your own.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing. But the paradox is, of course, that it's also the thing that adds a lot of pressure to young people because they see that, you know, if I'm not doing a job that I absolutely love all of the time, then I must keep looking. And that's another, you know, very significant social and emotional pressure that people can now feel that they couldn't feel 20 years ago. So I think, I mean, I'm not a technophobe, and I certainly think that technology has brought a huge amount of advantage to what it means to be human, let alone even talking about the medical and more obvious progression that has led to lower life expectancy.
Absolutely.
But if we're just thinking about the social impact, I'm not a negative person on that at all. I think there's huge advantages that we all take advantage of.
And, I mean, even from an emotional level, having that connectivity with so many people, not just in decades ago, it'd be your immediate circle of friends or the people that you work with or you go to school with and your family, and that would be about it. And you wouldn't be in a situation where you even had the opportunity to talk to other people. And that's where a lot of the old, very, very questionable ways of thinking that are now starting to change now in society. But, you know, you can have somebody that's going through a very challenging point in their life, and they can reach out through technology and find people in all corners of the world that are going through the same thing. And that's another great thing about the YouTube channel is that, as you said before, it's asking a lot of the videos are based around very naive questions and questions that people are just too scared to ask. And as soon as you watch some of these videos, you just get that reassurance that, you know, you're not alone. And just because your immediate circle of friends aren't talking about it, or they're probably all experiencing it in one way or the other over time, but no one's talking about it, doesn't mean that you're on your own. There are people that you can talk to near and far. So it's I see both sides of it as well, and I can see the negative aspect to where we're going with technology and whatnot. But I guess it just comes down to balance, and we have to continue to learn how to handle and how to navigate through the changes.
Yeah, and just being more conscious. I mean, that's the responsibility we have to take on ourselves. Because I think, you know, you and I that both have platforms that heavily utilize technology, whether it's the podcast or a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
You know, you can't. One can't throw rocks in glass houses. It's something we take advantage of every day. I guess the way I think about it, and some of our content on, you know, thriving in the digital age talks about just being being much more everyday conscious of the way we interact with technology. So, you know, for me, it played out when I was probably 12 months ago. I was overwhelmed with the launching of the school in Australia and feeling like it was, you know, very intense, and it was. And building a little organization and bringing on staff and raising money and all that sort of stuff that was always very intense. And what I was doing was I was listening to a lot of podcasts on the way to and from work. And I realized all of a sudden that, like, as much as podcasts are wonderful and I love them at the right time, filling your entire spare moments with other people talking to you and giving you information is actually can be quite negative to your kind of psychology and state of affairs.
This
20-minute period on the way to and from work was actually a huge opportunity to either put on some music I didn't need to pay attention to or just switch off entirely. That was a huge opportunity. You know, that was something I hadn't really appreciated. And so I stopped listening to podcasts for a while, and the walk to and from the train station and you know, getting to work became a kind of a moment of calm in the day that I just didn't have before. And so a lot of people, I think, who kind of have bought into the cult of busy in a way that's very holistic, there are actually moments in the day where you can switch off. There are times when you can just take a little moment for yourself. And it's important, I think, obviously, in an environment of ever-increasing stimulation to do that. It's all of our responsibilities.
I think that could be another podcast episode in itself. That's something that I'm in the process of. I'm only just starting to come out the other end of it, but there's this excitement of discovering so much, and I'm one of those people. I've got podcasts going left, right, and center. I've subscribed to way too many of them. I've got books that are piling up, and it gets to the point where you're listening to something and you're almost getting more excited about finishing the episode to get to the next one rather than actually listening to what the content is of the episode. And the same with books as well. And it's a bit of an epiphany in a way that I've had, because you sort of go, well, hang on, why am I doing it? Why am I taking in this information? What's the purpose of it? And I have found that not so much, well, yeah, the less that I digest, the more that I absorb. And it just takes a lot of pressure off, because I've just found that subconsciously I've put a lot of pressure on myself by trying to digest as much as I can. And it's been initially for exciting reasons, and I love to learn as much as I can, but it's become counterproductive as well. And I think just there's also that pressure that you put on yourself, that if you are sitting there and giving yourself some time just to calm down and clear your mind and whatnot, that it's actually a purposeful and constructive thing to do rather than a time waster like it may have been perceived, you know, in the past.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's rediscovering the joy of staring out a window, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We don't do much of that anymore. Well, I certainly haven't, but yeah, it's and I guess that's something that I've seen going back to you know, school of life and a lot of the things that are coming through there as well, is just taking a lot of the social pressure off, you know, the things that have been sitting there for a long time that subconsciously we're a slave to, and just, you know, realizing that we can slow down a little bit and it's not going to, you know, our lives aren't going to implode.
Yeah. And an important thing there, I think, is this, the counter movement for the conversation we're talking about is puts a lot of people off, I think, because of the structure and the connotations that come with it. So, you know, in particular things like mindfulness and yoga and Eastern thought, it's very effective to some people and a complete turn off to others. And I guess the important thing to remember in you know, when thinking about this stuff around the cult of busy and never switching off, and is that, yes, you could go and do a mindfulness course, or you could do yoga every morning, or you could, you know, do yoga and then put it on Instagram. You could do that stuff if you really wanted to. Or you can just make sure that in your day, one is a little bit more conscious about your surroundings and perhaps stop to talk to a stranger once a week. Like, there are other things that we can do to re-engage that side of our being, which doesn't involve joining another organization or starting a completely new practice, or, you know, which is good for some and really not for others. And to equate the idea of slowing down with, you know, picking up a new practice or doing yoga or these things, they're not the same.
Yeah.
And one can get the benefits from slowing down and being a bit more conscious without doing a full kind of rebirth of who we are. And that's important, I think, because some people will never engage in this conversation if they think they must go and learn about Buddhism and spirituality and yoga.
That's it. It's breaking some of the stereotypes around a lot of this. And yeah, it's I've certainly gone through it, going through the, I call it the 30 crisis period, and going back and reevaluating life and, oh God, what have I been doing for at least the last 10 years, let alone the last 30? And yeah, but just, I think the big thing is just for me, and I've only just started to calm down a bit, is that there is no rule book, so to speak, and you can be flexible, and when things do change, that you can survive and you can be happy, and it's all right to go through whatever life throws at you, and it's just taking a bit of that internal pressure off.
Yeah, and that is, I think, the what I found so attractive in the School of Life when I came across it was the lack of dogma in the questions. So, you know, if you're a mindfulness organization, that's your thing, that's what you do. And so although you can engage with these questions, you're putting forward mindfulness as a solution to these questions. And I guess with the school, what we're saying is we just want to talk about this stuff. We want to have a forum where people can come together and explore what it means to be calm in the modern world. And our role as the school is to provide almost a smorgasbord of cultural reference points that can just provide stimulation for good conversation. And so you might talk about, you know, Charles Darwin, who, you know, took a walk once or twice a day every day of his professional life so that he could be creative and come up with the theories he came up with. So the idea of being ritual in one's exercise or mindful pursuit, that's something we can learn from Charles Darwin. Now, you can also learn that from, you know, a deep investigation of spirituality and Buddhist principles, and that's wonderful for some people. But I think for us, we say, well, how do we use the examples from, you know, the great cultural figures and engage with it through that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm looking at the time. One last thing before we ended off. You mentioned before it's School of Life has started and formed in Melbourne, and from what I gather and what I've seen, there's been some pop-ups that have started in Sydney. And is the new site actually opened up now, or is it in the process of being opened up in Sydney?
Yeah, good question. So we've been launched in Melbourne for about touch over 2 years. We launched in March 2014 after a little pilot the year before. So we've been playing with it for a while in Australia, but we permanently launched a bit over 2 years ago in Melbourne. And the plan was always to take the school to other parts of Australia. We feel strongly that school can exist in lots of different forms. So in a city like Melbourne, you might have it as a permanent cafe, bookshop and classroom with, you know, I think we did more than 250 events last calendar year. So we can do a huge amount of programming in a city like Melbourne. We also think it can exist in smaller centres and regional locations in other forums. So the next step for us is to open in Sydney this year. We'll open permanently in July, which is big news and is only recently announceable. So that's really exciting. We've got a small team forming in Sydney and we'll be running year-round programming from late July this year. And then who knows? You know, we hope to be able to pop up in other locations. We did a big pilot festival in Perth last year, and we hope to do that again in the sort of midterm. I think pretty much watch this space. I think we're very keen to take the school to other parts of Australia in lots of forums and lots of forms. Starting with Melbourne and Sydney.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. I think once I discovered what School of Life was, and this was before the pop-ups began in Sydney, I was quite excited, but a bit disappointed that I was stuck in Sydney and it was all happening happening in Melbourne. But it's been great to see that it's starting to become a permanent thing up here. So that's going to be great. And hopefully I can convince some people to go.
No, absolutely. And look, put it this way. We ran a pilot in March in Sydney. We did 5 weeks of programming. We ran about 30 events in 32 days. Mm. And everything sold out. We had almost 4,000 people through our doors, our various events in a month. So
incredible.
Sydney is a big place and very different to Melbourne, but it's equally as strong an appetite for, I think, these conversations that we're trying to pursue. So, yeah, it'll look quite different and feel quite different in Sydney to what we are in Melbourne, but we couldn't be more excited and proud to be coming in July this year.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to put a bunch of links and videos and examples of what School of Life's all about on the website and online so everyone can get a taste of what it's about and hopefully reach out and experience it firsthand themselves. But it's an incredible thing. And up until recently, I wouldn't have even thought anything like this existed. So I think for a lot of people, it's going to be exciting once they discover that there is a model, and it's a new model, and it's something it's going to be continuing to evolve over time. It's just it's going to be incredible. So I'm looking forward to the chapters that come ahead.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on. I think it certainly is a particular time in human history when the idea of having these conversations in a secular, non-dogmatic environment is more important than ever. So we're sitting on something that I think is a really, hopefully will be a really important, shared cultural institution going forward. So, yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, no worries. Thanks so much for giving the time after a couple of attempts.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care, Kai. Thanks, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Apart from my dribble at times, hopefully you got something out of that. There's a lot of cool takeaways that I got personally, and hopefully it'll be the first of many conversations that I have with Kai over time down the track as things progress. And it's exciting to see School of Life opening up in Sydney. And if you are listening from abroad, there are a number of global offices as well. So get over to the School of Life website and check that out. There's heaps of resources there. And I'll have all the links on andysocial.net as well that you can check out. And my personal recommendation would be to check out the YouTube channel. There's hundreds of videos there. It's a great way of passing on ideas to other people. They're very accessible. They're very easy to watch. They're very, very well done. So I'll put some of my favorites on the website so you can use them as a starting point, and hopefully you'll dig deeper over time as well. I'll wrap this up very quickly because I'm trying not to dribble, and I've taken a million takes to try and record this outro. I have no idea, but my head is elsewhere today. AndySocial.net has got all the resources for all the previous episodes, so you can go on the website and check out any of the links and references that we've spoken about over the last however many months of podcast episodes. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, I'm on YouTube. I've got a Tumblr account that I just discovered that I'm going to start putting stuff on as well. I'm sure I'm on a million other different platforms that I can't even remember off the top of my head, but very easy to find. So if you want to reach out and give me any feedback or any ideas, or just let me know, let me know what you think of the podcast. It's much appreciated, and I'd be happy to talk. If you're listening via iTunes, rating and reviewing will make me very happy, and it's a massive help for the podcast to reach more people. If you're on YouTube or using any of the podcast platforms like Stitcher or Omni, any way of sharing links or leaving comments or just getting interactive with these podcasts makes just a dramatic impact for me getting out to more people. And this is all about making this bigger and better, not just for myself, but for everybody that listens as well. The more people that I listen that listen to the podcast, the more opportunities that we're going to get, the more people I'm going to be able to get on, and the longer this thing continues on in the future. It's just been amazing so far to date, and there's a lot of cool people and interesting things in the pipeline down the track. That's about it, guys. There's heaps more coming up soon. As you would have noticed over the past several weeks, I've upped the ante a little bit with podcast episodes. I'm going to try and maintain that as long as I can. We'll play it by ear, but it's incredibly fun, and I'm having a great time. So thank you so much, as always, for the support. Please keep sharing it around, and we'll speak soon. Bye-bye. Yo!